listening to KZUU 90.7 FM. This is the PES. KZUU presents a concert featuring killer rock star artist Jeff Hansen and KZUU's own Nameless Numbered Head. The show is Wednesday, September 21st at 8 p.m. in the Retrofit Gallery in Moscow, Idaho, 206 South Main. Come one, come all. Paging the Crime Doctor with Strychnine. A wicked sweet hardcore band is home base here right in Pullman. It's playing free for everyone. The show is at the studio across from Quiznos on Main Street in downtown Pullman on September 23rd. 9:30 p.m. is the show time. For more information, contact Ryan at 334-2301 before 8 p.m. Rock out. KZUU offers free public service announcements, just like the ones you just heard. You need to get the word out about your club or event, stop by KZUU's office in the Cub, room 311, and fill out a PSA form. Today on the PES, we'll be discussing sports, technology, and witty banter. Pullman Greyhounds played in Prosser, and they did very well down there. WSU Cougars, of course, over in Seattle against Grambling State, and then a Cougar Marching Band versus the Grambling State Marching Band. The NFL and the Seahawks. Also intramural sports and intramural softball. In the technology realm, we're going to be talking about fuel cells for electronics, Microsoft releasing some new software, and in the witty banter section, we'll talk a little bit about the 911 prank call that was thought to be a prank call. Whether or not wearing seatbelts is something that should be forced upon the general American citizen. So stay tuned. This is Scotty, and you're listening to the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower, the third floor of the Cub. In sports, we had quite the exciting weekend for several sports teams around the Palouse, starting with the AA Pullman High School going down to meet AAA Prosser High. Prosser High School, the Mustangs, are ranked number 4 in the state when it comes to AAA high schools. In Pullman, the Greyhounds, AA ball, good team. I don't know exactly what they're ranked, if at all, if they're in the top 10. They traveled to Prosser to see how things would go. And it was very clear from the start that Pullman had something going for them. They ended up beating Prosser 35-28 in an upset. They held Prosser to 14 yards of rushing for the whole game, while Pullman racked up 366 yards rushing. Pullman High School is going to open the Great Northern League play on Friday at Deer Park. Currently this season, Pullman High School is 3-0. Congratulations, Greyhounds. Thank you. luckily for all Cougar fans, we were able to hear this song a lot on Saturday. And Quest Field playing Grambling State. Granted, they are a Division II school, but it was a great chance to get out there in beautiful weather over in Seattle for once. See how the Cougs could do. Watch the Grambling State marching band. There had been a lot of people talking up the band, and I was really interested to hear what it was like and compare it to the Cougar marching band and see the differences and everything like that. But first, let's talk about the WSU versus Grambling. It wasn't even close from the start. It was pretty clear that WSU was going to have this game in no time. I sort of wonder from time to time if we had started our second and third string players, if it might have actually been a pretty darn close game and a little bit more interesting for the fans to watch. It's okay with me that we started our starters and got everybody some play time. I did notice that we saw Gary Rogers out there. I want to see that guy start passing the ball around a little bit. I want to see what he has. We saw, of course, Josh Swagger for a little bit, and of course, the starting quarterback, Alex Brink, who was 20. He had 29 attempts with 19 completions for 262 yards. Swagger had 6 attempts, 3 completions for 49 yards. Jerome Harrison ran 23 times for 113 yards, and Woolridge ran 18 times for 105 yards. That is just amazing play for the Cougars, especially when it comes to the running game, which has been lacking for so many years around here. WSU actually put in 43 different players during that game, so a lot of people came off the bench, had a chance to play the ball. The attendance at the Quest Field was actually 51,486, which blew the Huskies in the Air Force game a couple weeks earlier out of the water as far as attendance went, and that's pretty sad when the local team can't even get their own fans that fill a 70,000 a population, 70,000 people or whatever it is that can fit in their stadium. They can't even get 27,000 to go across the city to Quest Field to watch the Air Force game. Speaking of the Huskies, they actually did win this weekend against Idaho. I was really, really, really hoping for Idaho. They hadn't beat the Huskies since 1905, so this would have been the centennial of their last victory. I was really hoping Idaho would have had a little bit of a better showing in that game. I think Idaho played their best game against us so far this season. Anyway, talking a little bit more about the Cougar game, because we could really care less about Huskies around here. WSU pretty much just dominated in every statistical category there was. They had 15 more first downs. They had 204 yards rushing versus 11 yards rushing for Grambling State. For a while there, they actually, late in the third, fourth quarter, they actually had negative yards rushing. It was amazing to see. At the beginning of the game, at one point, I believe Grambling State had about 58 or 68 yards rushing. And throughout the rest of the game, the Cougars knocked them back to negative yards. So we killed a lot of their yards rushing. Total yards in the game, the Grambling State had 208. Cougars had 515 total yards. And what's sort of surprising is the final score for the Cougars of 48 with 515 yards rushing, or 515 total yards. I was thinking the score would be a little bit higher than it was. Guess that's due to a couple miscues that we had out there. The time of possession, surprisingly, was actually almost even. It was 29 minutes for Grambling State and 30 minutes and 54 seconds for the Cougs. So that was quite close. And the real telling stat was nice for the Cougs was 8 times in the red zone, we scored on 7 of them. And that was huge. Plus the sacks. 7 sacks for a loss of 45 yards, which means that we had quite a few tackles in the backfield for loss of yards as well. The next game for the Cougs will be on October 1st against Oregon State in Corvallis, Oregon. So tune in to Bob Robb and let's root the Cougars on to a victory in the first opening Pac-10 game of the season. And let's talk a little bit, just a little bit, about Cougs around the pros. Little story going around that may or may not have anything come, but Ryan Leaf, the Cougar great from 1997 that led us to the Rose Bowl, may be getting back into a pro uniform. The Ottawa Renegades are interested in talking to Ryan Leaf about playing in the CFL. Leaf was a first-round pick by San Diego in 1998 out of of course, Washington State. And unfortunately, due to injuries and other problems, he had an actually pretty dismal poor career. Hopefully, if he does get picked up, this would be a wonderful chance at redemption for him, at least. The problem, though, from what I understand, one of the biggest reasons why he could not continue in his pro career was because of an injury to his wrist, where his wrist was so messed up that each time he threw the ball really hard, it would actually, his wrist would go out of joint. And the players on the team would say that he'd be in the huddle banging his wrist against his thigh pads to get his wrist back in place so he can get it back in place so he can go out there and throw the ball again. So I'm really wondering if the guy's going to be able to make a career out of throwing the ball. What I understand is if he would have a surgery on it, which is the only thing that would fix it, would actually make it so he could never throw the ball effectively anymore and pretty much take out any opportunity of him ever being a quarterback. I don't know how much of that is official information. This is just things I've heard from other Cougar fans who are in the know or supposedly in the know. Also, we talked a little bit about Jason Gesser last week, and he had an opportunity to actually start his first game for the Calgary Stampeders. And luckily for Jason, the coach at Calgary is a very patient guy. Jason started out really, really poorly. He was 2 for 12 with 2 interceptions. And rather than pulling him right away, the coach gave him a little bit more time. You know, it's been 3 years since Gesser was out there getting a lot of play time, so you got to give the guy a little bit of time to shake some of those cobwebs out, especially in a game situation. But when they went out in the second half, he went 12 for 24 with 214 yards, ended the night with 3 touchdown passes, which led his Calgary Stampeders to the victory. He did end the night with 4 interceptions, so he got 2 more in the second half. But if you look at the second half alone, he did a pretty good second half. 214 yards passing, 3 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. Of course, we're forgetting about that first half. Hopefully, he'll get some more starts. The starting quarterback for the Stampeders actually went down with a broken thumb, is expected to be out for a couple more weeks as he had surgery on it. And that should give Gesser a fair amount of play time. And hopefully, we'll see the Gesser that we saw that took us to the Rose Bowl a couple years ago. So root on Jason Gesser, and if you have the opportunity to watch any CFL games, check out the Calgary Stampeders, and hopefully we'll hear a little bit more about Ryan Leaf possibly getting back into uniform. Switching over to the NFL, there's this pool, I guess you could say, that I'm part of. It's called the Horse Race, and the way the NFL Horse Race works is you get a group of guys together, everybody buys quote-unquote a horse, and it's for the league that we're in, it's $20, and it's a winner-take-all. And the way it works is you choose one team for week one that will win. If your team wins, you move to week two, and you choose one team that will win in week two. And if your team wins, you move to week three, and you keep on doing that. The only rule is that after you've chosen a team to win, you may never choose them again. So if you chose the Patriots to win week one, you would not be able to use the Patriots ever again for the rest of the pool. And so what gets hard is that if you use all the great strong teams early on, you're going to have to start looking for some upsets later on in order to win all the way out. The pool started with actually 34 people. So, winner take all, that's going to be about $680, which I'm hoping that I will be the winner. After the first week of play, there's only 12 people left. A lot of people got dumped out. I guess they picked the wrong teams. I'm so far 2 for 2. I picked Indianapolis, and man, Peyton Manning did not have a good game yesterday, but good enough to pull it out for the Indianapolis Colts and allowed me to move on to week three with about 12 other people left now. So hopefully I'll move along nicely. And for those who were watching the NFL games yesterday, you'll know most of this information. But for those who weren't, just quick rundown of some of the scores. The New York Jets over the Miami Dolphins, 17-7. Pennington had 190 yards passing. Kansas City 23, Oakland 17. Collins passed for 236 yards. Moss received 127 yards, but in a losing effort for Oakland. I was actually hoping that Oakland would pull this one out because there's a few people in my horse race that chose Kansas City, and they would have been knocked out. The New York Jets beating Miami did help knock out one person from our horse race. We had Denver over San Diego, 20-17. Plummer threw for 248 yards. The Cleveland Browns 26 and the Green Bay Packers 24. Trent Dilfer, former Seattle Seahawk, threw for 336 yards and three touchdowns. Great game for him. Brett Favre didn't have too terrible of a game either, unfortunately. He came up on the short end of the stick. Brett Favre is actually on one of my fantasy football teams, and he's helping to lead the way for my second victory in a row in that fantasy football league. The St. Louis Rams over the Arizona Cardinals, 17-12. Warner throws for 327 yards against his former team in a losing effort. We had Pittsburgh over Houston, 27-7. Carolina over New England, a big upset there, 27-17. Tampa Bay over Buffalo, 19-3. Philadelphia over San Francisco, big win here, 42-3. McNabb, 342 yards passing, 5 touchdowns. So if you have McNabb in your fantasy football league, you're loving life this morning. Indianapolis over Jacksonville, 10-3. That was the game that helped me stay in the horse race. Tennessee over Baltimore, 25-10. Cincinnati over Minnesota, 37-8. Wow, Minnesota's having a heck of a time out there. Mike Tice is the head coach on one of my other fantasy football leagues, and the one that I actually have to pay money on if I lose. And luckily, I was actually using John Gruden as my head coach versus Mike Tice, and we lose 10 points for every point lost in the game. So in the margin here was 29 points that Minnesota lost by, so I would have had negative 290 points if I chose to use Mike Tice. Thank goodness I didn't. And finally, Chicago over Detroit, 38-6. That was another game that took somebody out in the horse race. Tonight, there is going to actually be two Monday night games. The New York Giants are going to be playing the New Orleans Saints at Giants Stadium. However, the Saints are going to be the home team. It's sort of like when we played Idaho here in Martin Stadium, and Idaho was the home team. It was pretty much only the home team as far as numbers went, but everything else was Cougar home. We had our home colors and everything else on. Washington is going to be at Dallas tonight, so all the Cougars out there, be watching for Dallas. Root on Drew Bledsoe. We want to see him do really well. And, of course, the game that you've noticed that I missed until now is Atlanta at Seattle. It's 21-18 final score. A nail-biter at the end of the game. The Seahawks were a tale of two teams. It's almost like the Cougars scripted how to play that game. The Cougars are the perennial tale of two teams. One half, they are out there and they're kicking, but the next half, they're out there and they're doing nothing. I remember Apple Cup 1994, it was cold as heck. And first half, it was all Huskies. Second half, the Cougars came out and it was like a different team. I don't know what happened, if they got the fire lit under them. Mike Price might have said the right thing, but they came out there and the Cougars tied up the game. It was great. And the Seahawks seemed to do the same thing. First half, they could do nothing wrong. Everything went okay for the Seahawks. The second half was a different story. If it wasn't for the heroics in the first half, they would have never won this game because they could not muster even a field goal in the second half of the game. When they were in field goal range for Josh Brown, they ended up getting penalty, fumble. So, yeah, it was not good. Hasselbeck did end the night 20 for 31 with 280 yards passing, 2 touchdowns, and no interceptions. So he had a decent night. Michael Vick was 11 of 19 for 123 yards and a touchdown. Vick was also held only 43 yards rushing. The Seahawks did a great job in holding Michael Vick from doing what he can do for a football team. Sean Alexander for the Seahawks ran 28 times for 144 yards and 1 touchdown. Darryl Jackson led the receiving corps with 131 yards. And Jeremy Stevens, 49 yards receiving, and in the end of the first half, he made a diving play that was incredible to make a touchdown, and that happened to be the game-winning touchdown. That was the one that allowed the Seahawks to go on to win. The Seahawks defense, though they scored 18 points on us, the Seahawks defense held Atlanta to 223 yards total offense, which actually is not too bad at all. The Seahawks gained 428 on their side of the ball. For scoring for the Seahawks, we had Joe Jurevicius on a 6-yard touchdown pass. Then Sean Alexander had a 14-yard run. And the final score, of course, was a Jeremy Stevens. It was actually a 35-yard passing play. He laid out for it, caught it off the end of his fingers, and came up with it. It was an amazing play. The next game for the Seahawks will be Arizona at Quest Field at 1:05 for kickoff, and that's next week. So if you want to go check out some pro football action, head over to Seattle. Switching gears, let's talk a little baseball. For those who have not heard, Dan Wilson will be retiring at the end of the season. Dan Wilson has been the catcher for the Mariners for many years, and he was actually the last remaining Mariner from the 1995 season that saved baseball in Seattle. For those who don't know, Seattle was so close to losing the Seattle Mariners. They were ready to move away. 1994, they were really good. They had the strike, though. That really killed a lot of momentum for baseball in of itself, and then the Seattle Mariners already having a problem with people liking the team. The strike just almost killed them altogether. Luckily, the refuse to lose 1995 season was amazing. They did not say lose. They did not say die. They just kept battling and battling and battling. And when it looked they might only have a chance for a wild card at the end of the season, they said, no, wild card's not good enough. We're going to go all the way, and that they did. With the help of Dan Wilson and Randy Johnson and Edgar Martinez and many of the other guys, Jay Buhner, Ken Griffey Jr., they came back. And they forced the one-game playoff with California. Randy Johnson coming out, pitching in that game against Mark Langston, who was a former Mariner, and who we traded away to get Randy Johnson. Faced each other, and Randy Johnson, of course, was the victor in that game. Luis Soho had the sort of inside-the-park Little League home run, went down the first baseline under the Mariner bullpen, and he's running around the bases like crazy, and they're throwing the ball around, and at the very end, Mark Langston throws the ball away, and Luis Soho ends up scoring the final run. It was amazing. Then, of course, the Yankees come in. Actually, we go to Yankee Stadium, play against the Yankees, and the Yankees were on fire. They beat us Game 1 and Game 2, and Game 3, 4, and 5 were going to be held in Seattle. I had a ticket to go to Game 4, so I was on my way to Seattle from here to see the Game 4. I didn't even know that there was going to be a Game 4 because the Mariners had to win Game 3, and they ended up winning Game 3. I was there for Game 4. An amazing, amazing environment being inside of, at the time, the Kingdom, with how loud it was, with how many people that were there cheering on that team that saved baseball in Seattle. The Yankees ended up getting swept in Seattle. All three games, the Mariners won and ended up playing for the American League Championship Series. It was amazing. It was an improbable comeback in an improbable season that was, in a lot of ways, it's one of my favorite seasons ever. I mean, the 2001 season with 116 wins, the two out so what, all the magic they had there, that was great. That was a lot of fun to witness that and be part of that. But the 95 season, there was just something special about that team that just crawled their way back and crawled their way back and crawled their way back and crawled their way back. And Dan Wilson was the last standing Mariner from that 1995 team. And this is his last season. He's been out all season long with a knee injury. And he's hoping to make it back for a couple games at the end of the season, at least the final game of the season. He's really hoping to get out there for a little bit. So if you're a Mariner fan, if you're a Dan Wilson fan, if you want to salute the 95 season and the last man standing, I would get tickets to go see the Mariners. It would be a wonderful opportunity to say goodbye to Dan Wilson, who's been a rock behind the plate for so many Mariners for so many years. And on a unrelated note, but still dealing with the Mariners, unfortunately this weekend they got swept in Texas. Texas yesterday used five home runs to power themselves to an 8-6 victory. So they're not having quite the 95 or the 2001 season that they had a couple years ago, but they're still playing ball, and you got to root on your team. If you're a fan, you're not going to jump off the bandwagon just because they're having a bad season. I know a lot of people have, but you always got to root them on. I'm wearing my Mariners shirt today. They're up in Toronto. Going to see if they can't pull out a couple victories up there. Intramural sports. We have a couple intramural events coming up I wanted to let everybody know about. There's a four-person golf scramble. Sign-ups are September 12th, which is right now, through the 21st, which is 2 days from now, so hurry up there and get signed up. The play is on September 23rd, and it's $40 per team. There's a kickball tournament. Sign-ups are from now until the 22nd, and the games are on September 24th. That's $10 per team. There's a home run derby. Sign-ups today through the 29th. Play is on October 1st, and it's $2 per person. There's a punt pass kick contest. Sign-ups today through the 29th. Play is also on October 1st, and it's $2 per person. There's a badminton tournament. Sign-ups will start on September 26th, and they will end on October 6th. Play will be on October 7th. It's $2 for singles, $4 for doubles. For more information, go to urec.wsu.edu/im. We're going to go ahead and listen to a little bit of The Reverend, the favorite song of the PES. We'll come back and talk a little bit about softball, intramurals, and then we'll be going on to tech news you should know. You're listening to the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower, third floor of the Cub. You can reach us online at kzuu.org, or you could reach the PES website at thepes.com. On that website, you'll find information about today's show, past shows, recordings from the shows if you want to listen to audio downloads. There's pictures and some video clips of past guests. We have all the links from all the different sources we've used during the show. Most of the website is up and running. We still need to get the audio uploaded. There's a lot of audio from our show from a couple years ago that are still there that you could download and take a listen to. Also, you can reach me in the studio at 335-2207. That's 509-335-2207 if you'd like to talk about anything we're talking about here. You'd be more than welcome to call up. Once again, the show's website is thepes.com. Check it out and see what there is to see. So, softball games. We had a couple more softball games last night. I'm going to rant a little bit here. There's a team that signed up that did not show up for the games. They've now forfeited four games in a row, which means they're out of league. Why in the heck would you pay money to play softball and not even show up to one of the games? This has been happening for the last couple years. There's a spring season, there's a fall season. And it's happening every single season for the last couple years. A team will sign up, and then they will not show up and play. Some years we've actually had two teams not show up. I mean, it's not a lot of money, granted. It's like $30, but still, why would somebody pay $30 out of pocket and not even show up to a single game? It's really frustrating, especially for those of us who go out there to play softball. We only get six games in a season. And then when you get teams out there that sign up and don't show up, then that limits the number of games you get. Now, granted, the way my team's been playing lately, the free win is sort of nice. Gets us one win closer to going to the playoffs, which, you know, I would really prefer to play the game and lose than to get a win by not playing at all. So anyway, if you're going to sign up and play ball, or don't sign up and waste a position that another team could have signed up for. Anyway, getting to the games last night, there's a team called Don't Care. There are a lot of guys who play summer ball in the Pullman, Moscow area. A lot of them are in the A-League. Amazing players, most of these guys. They had a home run hitting show last night on Field 3, which is the one that faces Merman Drive in left field and the apartments in right field. Amazing. It is the longest porch to left field, I think, of any of the four fields out there at the Valley Road Playfields. It is a long, long hit to get it out of the park. and that's to left field. If you're going towards left center to center field, forget about it. It is just, it just doesn't happen. These guys hit 5 home runs out of the park on that field. Amazing. I've never seen a performance like that ever. Not on that field. It's just too long. These guys hit mammoth shots. That's all there is to it. Amazing. Interestingly enough, because there's 8 teams, 6 games, so you have the possibility of any one of 7 teams that you can play. As it turns out this season, the one team my team will not play is Don't Care, at least not in the regular season. We might see them in the playoffs, and that sounds like it will be a battle to beat those guys. Had another team that we're going to be playing on next Sunday. We watched them play the Swamp Donkeys, who crushed us last Sunday, and the Swamp Donkeys couldn't do anything right. They could not do anything right. There was a guy on first base. Swamp Donkeys were in the field. The batter hit a pop-up that went 30 feet down the first baseline. So the pitcher, the catcher, and the first baseman all had opportunities to get to the ball. Nobody got to the ball. The ball landed fair. The guy at first base, by all means, should have been thrown out at least at second base. He wasn't. And the guy who hit the ball made it to first. A 30-foot pop-up infield single. It was crazy. The shortstop had problems. They're throwing the ball around. They're throwing the ball away. They played perfect ball against us. But for some reason, when they played these other guys last night, they couldn't lose. Now getting on to our team. We actually beat a team that's been in the league for a couple years that, in all honesty, should be a rec team. They choose to play competitive because they choose to play hardball. I think that they're hoping to become better by playing at a higher level of competition. And I honestly think that it has helped them. They do appear better than they were a couple years ago. They have had steady improvements. They're a great team to play. They go out there, having fun is their number one priority. They could care less about the win. They're always laughing, having a good time. We end up 10 running them, so the mercy rule went into effect. We had no out in the fourth inning when we scored our 11th run. They had one, so then the inning was over because we were the home team, and that was it. So unfortunately, we didn't get a whole bunch of at-bats. We didn't get a whole bunch of runs to score on them. But for the Naders, we had Taj, who went 2-for-2 with 2 triples and 3 RBI, and Ben went 2-for-2 with 2 RBI. Ben was hoping this season to break the Naders' record of most home runs in a season, which is only 6 home runs in a regular season, which is 6 games long. So theoretically, it's doable, but Ben only has 2 home runs 4 games in the season, so he's going to have to really get his production numbers up for the next couple games in order for him to even tie the record, let alone beat it. So I wish Ben luck at it. It's a goal of his to get the record. If you're interested in seeing more of the records for the Valley Road Nader, actually, we're now the Murdivorous Psychophanic Naders. Change our name every couple seasons, pretty much. We've gone from the Procrustean Naders to the Naders to the Valley Road Naders to the Nacho Man Naders when we were sponsored by the Nacho Man, who's no longer in existence. Then the Darth Naders, and now we're at the Murdivorous Psychophanic Naders. So if you go to the website, www.softballteams.org/Naders, N-A-D-I-R-S, you can see all about our team history, all the players we've had through the doors of the softball team over the last 10 years, the awards that we've won, the Player Choice Awards, where we vote for other people for awards, and our current softball stats and other information, including the team records, which, like I said, home runs is only 6. So it's very doable. Ben is trying. I will give him that. He's hoping one of these days to get it. Now, I want to get back to the whole Cougar versus Grambling State thing. Ah, Pink Panther. If you were there at the game and you listened to the post-game show, when Grambling State was out there, the tubas were playing Pink Panther theme. So I was really amazed by how loud the Grambling State band was. I could not believe how loud they were. When I was sitting on the side of the stadium that they were sitting on, I was in the upper deck, like almost at the top. And when they were playing down below us during the game, I looked at the guy I was sitting with and I said, is that coming over the loudspeakers? I mean, it was so loud up there. It was crazy. It was just really amazing. And at first, I didn't know why they were so much louder than the Cougar Marching Band. But as I got out there on the field and marched around, I started realizing they don't have a lot of more of the quieter instruments, like, you know, your flutes and your clarinets. They have brass. They have your trumpets and trombones and tubas and all the really bellowing, loud instruments. So I think that made a huge difference over why they're so much louder than the Cougar Marching Band, who, you know, we have a large band. It's great to see the band, the Cougar Marching Band, compared to years ago. They were much smaller and not even all that easy to hear. But it's just amazing how the band has progressed over the years. But even with all the members we have, there's a lot of the instruments are not all the brass, loud brass instruments. So even though there's 200 plus people, not all of them of those 200 are playing super loud instruments. If they were all to play the really loud ones, then I'm sure we'd hear this band a lot better. But the Grambling State Band, it was really fun to watch their maneuvers, watch them marching around, watching them just having fun out there. The drum line was really neat to listen to. The thing that I thought was just the ultimate high class was when they were out there on the field, and towards the end of their show, they took Don Hauer out there, and then they took they're called the drum majors, something like that. They took them out there. Then they took Don Hauer. Then they invited the rest of the band out. And, you know, there's 500 people out there on the field running around, having fun, still playing some instruments and stuff like that. The one thing I was so hoping for, I didn't know if this was going to happen or not, and it did not happen. I think it would have just been the most amazing thing ever, is to hear the Cougar Marching Band and the Grambling State Marching Band do the Cougar Fight song at the very end. I mean, 500 people with as many instruments as they had and as loud as it would have been the most amazing thing to be able to do the fight song with all those people. Unfortunately, that did not happen, but it still doesn't take away from the classiness that the band had coming out and bringing the Cougar Marching Band out there to help, you know, enjoy the time and get a little bit of the spotlight and get some of the applause. It was an amazing experience, and I was glad I stuck around for it. So to the Grambling State Marching Band, to the Grambling State football team, to the Cougar fans, who I'd like to point out, I was very impressed with the Cougar fans. I have no problem at all when the other team, like UCLA or UW or USC, goes running out on the field when our fans boo them and let them know, hey, you're in our house. But I was so happy that the Cougar fans did not boo Grambling State. I think it showed a lot of class. By that time, we were already beating them pretty heavily. I think it showed a lot of class by our fans for just remaining quiet. They didn't necessarily applaud them, but they didn't boo them, and I think that was great. I mean, it would have showed a real lack of class to go out there and boo a team that, you know, really we had no business playing. They went out, they played their hearts out. Cougs, by all means, they played their hearts out. They had 43 players in that game, and they, you know, a lot of the second, third stringers got a chance to play some ball, and more power to them. I'm glad for them. It's always fun to see these guys that are out there busting their buns every single day in and day out, to be on the Cougar team and pretty much stand on the sidelines all game long because it's going to be a close game or whatever. So when they get a chance to get in the game, you know, we got to cheer those guys on because they've put a lot of work in just to be standing on the sidelines, let alone getting out there on the field and making a tackle or running around and knocking down passes or whatever else. So to the Cougs, great game. To Grambling State, you were a fun team to watch. Your marching band was great. They had a lot of class. The Cougar fans had a lot of class, and I really appreciate what everybody did out there. Switching gears to tech news you should know. Microsoft Expression to compete with Adobe System and Macromedia, as reported by the Bloomberg News. The software will be used for designing graphic and layouts in software programs and building web pages. It's supposed to be released in 2006. The software could be appealing to graphics designers who are able to translate their ideas directly into code rather than through a software developer. Now, I have a problem with that because I am a software developer, so I really don't like the idea that there's going to be a program that might take my job away. I don't honestly think that that's going to happen anytime soon, but it's just sort of an interesting thought that maybe one of these days, me being a code monkey isn't going to pay the bills. Anyhow, also in April, Microsoft announced a technology that's going to rival Adobe's PDF file format. And the PDF is sort of the de facto way of saving files on the internet for people to download and take a look at. I cannot stand PDF files. It takes forever to load up. They're huge. It's slow to load. You always get those, there's new updates to this window. I mean, it's frustrating, and I hope Microsoft's solution is less bloated and a lot quicker to load and isn't always whining that it needs updates. Now, this is sort of interesting. There's going to be a mixture of methanol and music. Toshiba is gearing up to release a fuel cell cartridge that is powered by methanol that could keep an iPod running for an additional 2.5 days without a recharge. The Tokyo-based company said that it's testing prototypes of what it calls a direct methanol fuel cell, or a DMFC. The cartridge contains a passive supply of an alternative fuel in a highly concentrated form, which produces electricity by causing a chemical reaction. After 3 years of delay, Toshiba said commercial products based on this technology are expected to appear on store shelves in 2007. The fuel cells usually use alcohol or hydrogen as a fuel, can offer up to 5 to 10 times the power per unit weight as lithium-ion batteries. For more information on the story, go to ZDNet.com. So I find that was a sort of just an interesting concept that we might actually have. We might actually have a fuel cell to power our equipment rather than batteries. I find that to be darn amazing, and I think that's sort of an exciting idea that we might not have to run out and buy batteries continuously from the store, that we might just be able to recharge our fuel cells. Maybe there'll be little recharging stations around the house, and or maybe you can even carry them with you, like a little light or something like that, a little Bic. You just hook it up and boom, you're filled up again and ready to go with more battery power. I mean, how great would that be? Well, it's just about 2 o'clock, and we're going to listen to the PES's favorite band, Reverend Horton Heats. You're listening to the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower, the third floor of the Cub. Reach us on our website at www.thepes.com. Reach our station's website at www.kzuu.org. Reach our studio line, 335-2207. That's 509-335-2207. We'd like to hear from you. Need a place to live? Looking for a roommate? The ASWSU Housing Commission can help. Visit the Housing Commission's website at cub.wsu.edu/hc for a renter's guide and housing listings. They will also place an ad for you for free. For more information, call them at 335-9574. Had a rough weekend? Are you in need of free legal advice? Contact Student Legal Services for a free 30-minute consultation. Or visit their office in the Cub 316 or on the phone 335-9539. If you'd like to have a PSA read, come pick up an application. Pick up a form even at the Cub Room 311, KZU's main office. Okay, now to witty banter. This is the politics, the portion of the show that I find to be fun, but at the same time can be hard for some people to listen to. But let everybody have an open mind. I love to debate topics. I'm a philosophy major. I'm all about debating without personal attacks and ad hominem arguments. And, you know, I might get information and facts wrong from time to time, and that's what the whole idea of debate is. Let's figure out who's right and get things done correctly, huh? And last week we talked ever so briefly about this Hurricane Katrina stuff, and I really honestly still don't want to get into it too much because I really... It's such a politically charged issue, and it seems like it's waning just a little bit now. It's not quite as bad as it was last week and the week before when everybody was screaming and yelling that it was all Bush's fault because everything that happens in the country today is Bush's fault, no matter what. If I stub my toe, it's Bush's fault. I can find a reason for it to be Bush's fault that I stubbed my toe. Everybody finds some reason to blame Bush. Anyway, Bush said something in his Katrina speech that, oh man, I didn't like too much. Well, there's quite a few things I honestly did not like too much. I mean, it's all nice and good, all touchy-feely, and it sounds like a great plan to help get everybody back on, back going again and stuff. But you got to question the idea of building, you know, 10, 15 feet under sea level in a place that's only held by levees. You know, the city of Pullman has a trailer court that's right off of the river. And they've actually made it now that when a trailer burns down, which happens from time to time, or moves out of that park, it cannot get replaced with another trailer. Once the last trailer's gone from that park, it's closed. It will never be used again because of the flooding problems. So rather than, okay, let's spend a crud load of money and get that area up to sea level. Or, hey, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't build too much there. Or maybe the things we do build there should be built where the lowest levels are maybe only parking. And you got to go up 20 feet, 30 feet before you get to the main areas of anything. There's going to be, what, 200 billion of our tax dollars being spent on this process, and it scares the heck out of me. That's a lot of money. That is a ton of money. And the government has not a penny of that $200 billion. I have it, and you have it, and every other taxpayer has that money in our pocket that somehow it's going to not be there anymore because it's going to have to go and pay for this. $200 billion. Think about that. There's only 200 million, 220, 250 million Americans, and not all of them pay taxes. So we're paying a magnitude of 10 of what it's crazy. Actually, it's more than a magnitude of 10, isn't it? It's like a magnitude of 100 or 1,000 or whatever. I mean, that's a lot of money that we're going to have to pay just to fix what broke when Hurricane Katrina hit and when the levee failed. So, should we be spending that money down there? Should we be building something that someday will happen again? You cannot ever guarantee to me that that levee will be indestructible. Something will happen someday. Heck, who knows? Maybe a local terrorist will take a Cessna 182 and fly into the top of the levee with a little bit of explosives on board and blow a little hole in it or something like that. Something can happen to the darn thing, and it scares the heck out of me that we're going to pay all this money. Hopefully, it will be long after my lifetime and everybody else's lifetime, and we won't have to pay for a second round down there. So anyway, during this speech, talked about a lot of things, talked about the rebuilding of this and that and getting, you know, people houses rather than making them live in slums and all that kind of stuff. And actually, I think those are neat, great ideas. I mean, and really, if the time's going to happen, the time is now to do it. It's sort of like you've had a chance to wipe the slate clean. You've had a chance to pretty much, you know, wipe out most of the city and start over. Not many cities get that opportunity. Not only that, not many cities get $200 billion from the government to do it. Too bad some of these cities around here couldn't get $200 billion to flatten the whole thing and rebuild it even better than it was before. But anyway, one thing Bush said was, it is clear now that the challenge on this scale requires greater federal authority and a broader role for armed forces. the institution of our government most capable of massive logistical operations on a moment's notice. So what Bush is saying is he now wants greater federal authority over what's going on in local government situations. So we're moving a little bit farther away from the states and moving a little bit closer towards federals. And I don't like that idea. I don't like it at all. It's the role of the state and the local government to do what they need to do to make sure the people in their cities and their state are safe and protected. And the federal government needs to come in only when asked by the state and local government when they are overwhelmed because of how big it is. But it's not Bush's job to all of a sudden say, oh, geez, there's a big old tornado or hurricane or earthquake going on. I'm going to send the federal government in and displace all the state and local governments. No, it doesn't work that way. Local government, state government says, hey, feds, can you come in and help us? We need your help. It doesn't work the other way around. So people blaming Bush for everything that went wrong with the government responses is what's causing this kind of greater federal power that Bush is wanting to take. Essentially, and in all honesty, I don't blame him. He's getting so much heat from so many people over the federal government doing everything wrong and everything's being blamed on Bush. The person who's stuck in his house is blaming Bush that he's stuck in his house with water all around him. So if Bush is going to get blamed for all this stuff, he might as well take over and execute it himself. So then if it does go bad, he can be properly blamed for it. But right now, people are blaming him for things that he had no control over because he wasn't the direct line of government over those people at that time. So it's really sad that Bush is going to have to resort to that because of all the people who chose to be in the position they were in, and now they're blaming Bush. For instance, you had all the people in the Superdome who were without food and water, that were having so many problems there in the Superdome, and they needed to get out of there. There was nothing to drink, and everybody was hating life there. But what was interesting is, you know, and of course people are blaming Bush for the whole deal because, you know, if Bush had, used his cape and went down there and used his superpower breath and blew the hurricane to hit, say, Mexico or over to Florida where they're used to that kind of thing, it wouldn't have been a big deal. But unfortunately, Bush didn't do that. He was too busy on his ranch doing other things, right? So this big, huge hurricane hits. Yeah, a hurricane. A relatively slow-moving storm that takes 3 or 4 days from where it was to get to where you are. You know, you could walk away in 3 to 4 days to get to higher ground. You could have run. You could have driven. You could have done so many things to get out of the way of something like that. You know, it's like when somebody says there's a tidal wave coming, most everybody's running to high ground. There's a few guys that run down to the beach because they want to see it. Those are the ones that are probably going to die. And you know what? I don't shed many tears over stuff like that because if you're running down to see a tidal wave, you're a couple screws loose upstairs, and you know maybe that cleans out our gene pool a little bit. So you have this Category 5 hurricane coming at your city that is under sea level, and you're like, "Nah, I'm going to ride this one out. I'm not going anywhere." And then, of course, when things do go bad. Oh, geez, I'm going to blame Bush on this one because, you know, I don't like George Bush, and he's at fault because, you know, he should have done something about this. He should have driven the buses. He should have come to my house and told me to get out of my house. I'm not smart enough to know that when there is a Category 5 hurricane coming to my city that's 17 feet under sea level, that I need to be running out my front door, taking my dog and getting to high ground. No, I'm not smart enough to do that. I have to wait and blame Bush after the water surrounds me. The Superdome. There's all these people here. The government says, hey, go to the Superdome. That's going to be our refuge. So food and water is being taken to the Superdome. And guess what? The local government authorities say, no. You're not bringing that stuff here because if you bring that stuff here, more people are going to try to come here. And we're trying to get everybody who's here out of here. So, in the meantime, the people who are there aren't getting the food and water, and who are they blaming? Bush. Not the local government who said, no, don't bring this stuff here. They're blaming Bush. Once again, how is it that Bush can get blamed for all this stuff when it's the state and the local government that needs to be taking care of their local people and calling on Bush only when they need his help? It's not the other way around. Bush doesn't just step in. That's not his job. But he tried, actually. He called the governor days ahead of time and said, hey, you know what? You need to issue an evacuation notice. You need to get these people out of the area. But Bush had to beg for this to happen. And yet, it's Bush's fault because he didn't do enough. Well, you know what? He did what he had the power to do. He did what he tried, what he could do as a human being to get the governor to do what was right. And Bush gets blamed for this. It's insulting that everybody wants to blame Bush for everything. You know, there were people who were in bad situations. There were people in the nursing homes and hospitals that needed help to get out of town. Well, you know what? You had a local government that should have been doing that. You had the owners of maybe the old folks' homes and stuff like that should have been getting their people out of town. That's not Bush's fault. It's not Bush's fault that the local government didn't take care of the people, that the hospitals didn't get evacuated in time. It's not Bush's fault that people chose to stay where there's a Category 5 hurricane coming towards a city that's under sea level, and people are like, no, I'm going to ride this one out. And then what's funny is they're running around, in some cases, just taking water and food for what they needed in order to survive. In all honesty, I actually do have a small problem with that, because I honestly think that, yes, it's a survival situation. You got to do what you got to do. But at the same time, you would not have been in that situation if you had heeded the word of warning when it finally did come out and got out of town. Yeah, a lot of people, oh, no, the streets were packed. You couldn't get out of town. People running out of gas. We were stuck. Well, you know what? I saw a lot of people walking around stealing stuff. I saw a lot of people moving around. You know what? Those two legs they're using to move around could have moved them to higher ground if they chose. But no, they wanted to stay under sea level with a Category 5 hurricane coming. So I think that they were not thinking clearly. I don't know what to think other than the fact that when people say, hey, big storm, under sea level, lots of water, coming right at you, get out of town, that's not clear enough to me. Make it more clear next time. Maybe you should come and hold my hand and take me to the bus and move me out of town. Maybe Bush ought to do that, because it's obviously Bush's fault that that the state and the local government failed to do what they needed to do. If you have a comment on this situation, give me a call at 335-2207, or you can hit me up on my website at thepes.com and leave your comments there. I've ranted a little bit about that, and like, I didn't really want to get into it. I really, really didn't. But it's frustrating to listen to everybody continuously blame Bush and not be realistic about the situation. The first place of blame needs to be the guy in the mirror. The guy in the mirror knew what was coming at him. The guy in the mirror should have known where he was living. The guy in the mirror should have been the one to take responsibility for his own health and his family's health and his pet's health and everything that he cared about and got out of town. He had warning. He had time. It's not like the tsunami that just hit out of the blue. It's not like they were there and then all of a sudden these things happened. They knew it was coming for days and days and days, and they chose to do nothing about it. So let's not blame other people. Let's put the blame where it lies, and it's with the guy in the mirror first, above all else, above the governments, above everybody else. It's the guy in the mirror that needs to have the blame for that one. Alrighty, I've said my piece, and now let's move on to something that's not quite vastly dividing, but an interesting story all the same. It's about seatbelts. On September 17th of 2004, for those who don't know what 2004 is, the Daily Nebraskan published an opinion piece titled Individual Rights Buckle Under Seatbelt Laws, and it was written by Derek Kuiper. At the time of the opinion piece, he was a junior at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He had a 4.0 grade average, and he had actually five majors: economics, history, sociology, psychology, and political science. The guy sounds like he was very smart, sounds like he was doing a lot of work in order to sustain five majors. So in the opinion piece, in the Daily Nebraskan, in part, he wrote, "I'm from the school of thought where everyone should have the right to do as they please as long as they are not infringing on the rights of other people. This comes from the political philosophy that inspired our founders and freedoms. The duty of government is nothing more than to make sure everyone's rights are protected and not infringed upon. Uncle Sam is not here to regulate every facet of life, no matter the consequences. No law or set of laws has been made by the government that are more intrusive and ridiculous than seatbelt legislation. Nothing is a bigger affront to the ideas of liberty, freedom, yada, yada, yada. Whether you are a pinko liberal or a right-wing whack job, there are plenty of reasons for just saying to hell with the seatbelt laws. As laws become increasingly strict for seatbelts, fewer people will respond positively by buckling up in response to the laws. There seems to be a diehard group of non-wearers out there who simply do not wish to buckle up no matter what the government says. I belong to this group. What frightens me more about safety belt laws is the intrusion they represent to Americans. Democrats should take notice. Choice is an important aspect of freedom. Choice to do as I see fit with my body and my being. Yet the government has decided that I do not have the choice to drive around without my seatbelt. And if I want to be a jerk that flirts with death and rides around with my seatbelt off, I should be able to do that too." He included stuff about tax money that was being used to make the laws happen and stuff about states' rights. I was mainly focusing on the personal choice issue. I know it's good to wear a seatbelt and that it saves lives. Many of the deaths due to not wearing a seatbelt is because the bodies hit windshields or bodies are partially ejected from the car and then the car lands on top of you, or sometimes you're thrown free of the car, sailing headfirst into a rock or a tree or a telephone pole or another car or something else, and that kills you. I usually wear a seatbelt. The only time I leave it off typically is going back from the store to my house on a couple of the back roads where I'm the only one driving. But the point is, should the government force people to wear seatbelts? My old neighbor one day was talking about this, and he said, "What if that was my way of seeking thrills? Some people bungee jump. I don't wear a seatbelt." It's not the job of government to save people from themselves. That was never a function of government, nor should it be. So I agree with Derek that it should be a personal freedom to wear or not to wear. I choose to wear. He chooses not to wear. On January 4th of 05, 4 months after the opinion piece was printed, Derek was riding in a Ford Explorer with two friends. They were buckled up. He wasn't. It was about 3 o'clock a.m. when the Ford Explorer hit a spot of ice, skidded off Interstate 80 just outside of Lincoln, and rolled several times, throwing Derek out of the car. The other people in the car lived, and Derek is forever 21. It's sort of sad. The guy died. 21 years old. 4.0, 5 majors. Dead. Because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. So the point is, you should wear your seatbelt. The other point is, the government should not force you on the fact that it should be your right if you want to wear one or not. As a smart person, you wear one. But at the same time, you need to also protect your own rights, and you need to say, "Hey, government, step back. As much as I love the fact that you're being mommy for me, I don't want you to do that. It's my choice if I want to wear it. And if I die, guess what? It's me that's dead." So I guess I can understand in some ways the government might be saying, "Well, you know what? If you die, we don't get tax money from you, so we got to keep you alive as long as we can to get as much money as we can out of you." So I guess if the government takes that point of view, they're just, in their view, protecting their investments. Okay. It is about 2:30. We got the favorite band of the PES, Reverend Horton Heat, queued up and ready to go. We also have one more issue we're going to talk about, a 911 call that was thought to be a prank. The story was from back in May, and the situation was somebody died because this was thought to be a prank, and in reality, it was a real call. But I have a couple thoughts on that. If we have time, I'm going to discuss a story that we discussed on this show a couple years ago that I looked into a little bit more and got a little bit of resolution on that we did not have when the story was first aired on the PES. This is KZUU 90.7 FM. Our website is www.kzuu.org. Our studio line is 509-335-2207. And the PES website is thepes.com. Now, the Reverend. The Reverend. Reverend Horton Heath, the favorite of the PES. Once again, this is KZUU 90.7 FM, and this is the PES. You're listening to Scotty, broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower, third floor of the Cub. Reach us at our studio, 335-2207, on the web, www.kzuu.org, and for the PES website, it's thepes.com. I'm going to talk about that 911 prank call from back in May, but just before that, I have to say something. I'm going to be having people from PARD on the radio with us in the next week or two. We're going to talk about what PARD is all about. The PARD is the group that is heading the biggest opposition of the Walmart coming here to the city of Pullman. PARD, I believe, stands for the People for... let me see here. P-A-R-D. The People... Pullman Responsible Development. I know that. You know what? I should know this off the top of my head, and I feel really bad for not. Anyway, they're about responsible development. They think that the development in Pullman is good, but it needs to be done in what they call a responsible manner. So we need to talk to them and find out what exactly is a responsible manner for development. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the biggest problems they have with the idea of the Walmart coming. I've read their report that they put out, and there's some information in there that we'll hopefully talk about, and we'll get a chance for people to call in if they have any questions or comments, and hopefully when you hear from PARD, you'll have a better chance to understand at least PARD's arguments and PARD's issues with the Walmart coming to town. That said, something happened today that made me go, gosh, you know what? I wish there was a Walmart in town. And it wasn't necessarily that it had to be a Walmart. It could have been a CompUSA, could have been a Magnolia audio video, it could have been almost any kind of high-tech store, to be honest with you. Didn't have to be a Walmart, but I know Walmart would have had what I needed. As it turns out, I can record this show in one of two ways. I can record it on a mini disc, or I can stream it to my computer back in my office and turn on a program that I have called Total Recorder that will record the stream over the internet. That's all fine and dandy as long as the stream doesn't die or my computer doesn't run out of space or some other major catastrophe happens with the internet connection. So if I record it on the mini disc, it would be a better recording and I would be sure that I would get it every single time. So I thought, hey, I'll go out and get a mini disc. And I was like, okay, we're in Pullman, where should I go? And I'm sure everybody's thinking right now, you idiot, go to Radio Shack. And I did. And they have them, but they're currently out of stock. So I was thinking, okay, Radio Shack's down. We have a couple other stores that are possibilities, so I'm going to try those. I had to go to Safeway to get some supplies, so I went to Safeway and I checked out their little audio video section, nothing. Went over to Rite Aid, checked out their audio video section, nothing. I was nearby, so I popped into Crimson and Gray. I was thinking, hey, maybe, just maybe, they have that as supplies for students. Nothing. So I went over to Shopko, nothing. So striking out. Had Walmart been there right across from Safeway, I would have popped in, got my mini discs, and I would be recording the show right now. So, once again, though, that's not to say that it had to be a Walmart. It could have been a lot of other stores, too. It's just ironic that a Walmart would have had it, and I would have been able to get it today. There's one other possible place I could have gone. The people at Crimson and Gray, and actually a few other people mentioned that maybe the bookie has the mini discs. and so I was thinking I could go there. However, I'd have to A, pay for parking, and B, I was already running late, so I didn't really have time to run there and get to the show on time. So I couldn't go there. And so there's the other ironic thing about this, is that I don't like the idea of the bookie taking the space away from students in the Cub, in the new Cub. I don't like the idea that our game room is gone. Our place to go bowling and play pool and relax is gone in order to be able to buy books. You know, it's like, honestly, we use the bookie in a major way at the beginning of the semester and the end of the semester. Does it really need to be on the center of campus? Where parking is even worse. Getting here is even worse. Granted, for all the people living in the res halls, hey, it's not too bad of a walk. But you know what? It's not worth it. It's not worth taking up half of the Cub to turn it into a mall. I'm going on a little rant here. I'm sorry about that. But the ironic thing is, that's the way I feel about it. I don't like the idea of them coming in here, turning the Cub, the Union Building, into a mall with as much space that that bookie will be taking up on as many floors as it's going to be taking it up, and as many things they're going to take away from the students in order to have a bookstore in the Cub. I'm against it. But ironically, if the bookstore was here today, and I was running late like I was today, and they had many discs, like they supposedly do, I could have actually just went to the bookie here in the Cub and grabbed them before my show. So, yeah, it's sort of ironic, but I'm still totally against the idea of the bookie, Barnes & Noble, moving onto campus. I mean, it's like, is the Cub a mall, or is the Cub the Union Building? So let's decide on that. And I don't think that... I don't think things are going to change. I think the bookie's new location is going to be right here in the Cub. And some people have mentioned, hey, you know what? Once you move the bookie here, you could possibly move some of the student activities into the old bookie building, which makes me scratch my head. It's like, what's the point then? Why move things from point A to point B and then the other thing from point B to point A when you could just leave them as they are now? Anyway... I've beat the dead horse into the ground a little bit. Oh, cops. The kind of people you might get a hold of if you dial 911. So here's the story. This actually happened. This happened back in May. There was a man named David Steves. He was a 19-year-old. He was in the trunk of his mom's car when he called 911 in Elgin, Illinois. They asked him where he was, but he didn't know for sure because he was in the trunk of the car. At one point on the 911 recording, you can hear him saying, "Oh my God, you got to please help me. Please help me. Oh my God, please help me, God." It was actually sort of heart-wrenching to listen to because you knew this guy died. You knew this guy got killed. And he was alive at that moment. You know, I mean, it's like, gosh darn it, if they could have just got to the guy. Well, all he knew is that he was on South Street. The police spent about 10 minutes looking for him and chalked it up. Ah, it's a prank call. We're going to go away with it. So, 6 days later, nobody's seen or heard from him until they found him shot to death in the trunk of his mom's car. It's actually sort of a sad story. A 19-year-old guy, dead, thrown to the back in the trunk of his mom's car and shot to death. That's not fun. That's sad. But you know what? You've learned a little bit more about the story, and then you almost say, you know what? Yeah, I'm not too sure that I'm quite as sad as I was about it when I first heard about it. As it turns out, he was in the middle of a drug deal, and the dealers decided to rob him, throw him in the trunk, and then kill him. So it's sort of one of those, another case of a criminal on criminal crime. You know, and I think it's like, I think to myself that, well, you know what, maybe if he wasn't out there doing drugs and buying drugs on the street corner, he wouldn't be dead right now. Sort of the kind of thing that makes you shrug your shoulders anymore and just move on with life. It's a criminal versus criminal crime. You know, but then again, this is Bush's fault. If Bush legalized drugs, this kid would not have had to been on the corner buying drugs from these drug dealers. He could have bought them at the local store, and he wouldn't be dead right now. He would be legally doing drugs. He wouldn't be he wouldn't be overcrowding all our prisons with all the people who are such innocent, nice people that only do drugs as their only crime. And if Bush would just do what he needs to do and legalize drugs, kids wouldn't be on the street corner buying drugs. They wouldn't be ending up dead in the back of their mom's car. So once again, it's Bush's fault. Why don't we figure out how to get rid of Bush? Because obviously, he's not doing enough to legalize drugs. All right, on with this story. Now that the deed has been done, I hope that both of those murderers get the death penalty. That would actually take care of three criminals. One has already been taken care of, and the rope will take care of the other two. Like Charlie Daniels says, take a big tall tree and a short piece of rope, hang them up high, and let them swing till the sun goes down. Alrighty, you don't like me anymore, do you? Give me a call, 509-335-2207, or reach us on the web, www.kzuu.org. This is the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower, third floor of the Cub. Let's talk, I told you a little bit about a story that took place on the show a couple years ago. And there's been a few updates since the time the story was first talked about. And the issue was actually on gay privacy on trial. And there's a lawsuit over a teen suicide. And it was going to court. Essentially, there was an argument made whether the 14th Amendment covers the privacy of whether you're gay or not. And what happened was, this actually started way back in 1997. There was an 18-year-old high school football player in a small town in, called Minersville. And he was with a 17-year-old friend. They were stopped by police after leaving a party. The police charged the boys with underage drinking. After finding the younger one with two condoms, they took him to the station and lectured him on the Bible and homosexuality. The arresting officer, F. Scott Wilianski, allegedly asked if they were queer and threatened to tell their families they were gay. Marcus Wayman, the football player, told his friend he was going to kill himself. A few hours later, he did just that. So the mother of Marcus filed this lawsuit that had been going through the courts for a while, and they were trying to throw it out originally because the police were like, no, there's no expectation of privacy on the fact if you're gay or not. And the courts actually ruled that, yes, there is the expectation of privacy on sexual orientation. So it was actually going to be able to be pressed through the courts. The officer who had been questioning said in testimony that the boys conceded under questioning that they had stopped to have sex. The 17-year-old disputes making this statement. The 18-year-old football player, of course, can't dispute it because he killed himself over the fact that he was going to be outed in a small community where his grandfather would have had a really hard time with it, whether it was true or not. The kid felt that was his only way out of the situation. So he ends up finding a gun, and 4 hours later, he was dead. The officer, according to the latest information, never actually got a reprimand for it. It's still on the police force. And the case was actually finally settled for a very, very, very small amount of money that the family said was insultingly small. So that was a very interesting case that has been going on for several years. And it brings up, do the police officers need to protect whether somebody is a homosexual or not when they find that information out? And according to the way this particular case was going, it would seem that the cops do need to make sure that they don't run around and spread the word that so-and-so is a homosexual. All right, let's listen to a couple more minutes of the Reverend, and we'll wrap up the show. I appreciate you listening, and we'll be back next week, too.
It's the Psychedelic Freakout!
Thank you, Reverend. We do love you here on the PES. Finally, in today's show, I would like to talk a little tiny bit more about the situation, I don't really want to do this. But if you read the Evergreen on the 16th, there was yet another editorial about the whole situation with Bush not liking black people, and that's why he waited so long in order to get federal resources down there. And once again, it's so frustrating. There's that actually. This person says that they think that there is a lack of gut level sense of dire importance, and it's just frustrating to listen to that kind of stuff go on and on and on and on and on and on and on without it being responded to. I wish people would respond to that kind of stuff. Alrighty, it's 2:51. Coming to the end of the show, we're going to finish out the show with some more Reverend, but one last thing I'd like to say is we have the vote coming up here super duper soon, and there is Proposition 1 on the ballot, and it is for a sales tax increase of 0.1%. So our sales tax would go here from 7.6% to 7.7%, which of course is well below what you pay in Seattle or even Spokane, but it's a little bit higher than what we're paying here currently. But that money goes to something that actually is what I believe to be a needed place. The Whitman County Jail and Juvenile Justice Department, they have a system in place. The jail was built 21 years ago with an intercom system and a video system of that era. It is in dire need of being upgraded. The jail itself is in just dire need of upgrades. The jail was built for 28 people. There's currently 55 people housed there. I know a lot of people have that mentality that, who cares if criminals have to sleep on the floor? Who cares? Just pack them in like cordwood. We don't really care that they're overcrowded. Boo-hoo. Don't commit a crime. Don't go to jail. You won't have to be in an overcrowded place. I know that kind of sentiment. I hear it all the time. But that's not the point. The point is the jail was built for a lot less people than are currently there. And the problem is you get to a point when the jail is so full, they just cannot take new criminals. What that means is, rather than saying, oh, boo-hoo, just pack them in, it ain't going to happen forever. What's going to happen pretty soon is people are going to be turned away. People who have committed crimes will be turned away from jail. They'll be out on the street with you, even though they've committed a crime. You don't believe me? Find out from Spokane County, Whatcom County, King County, Assotin County, and many other counties who turn away criminals based on what crime they were. If they're lower level crimes, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, they're turned away because there's not enough space in their jails. Whitman County does not do that currently, even though the population is almost more than twice what the jail was built for. They do not turn people away. And that's a thing that we're lucky about, but it cannot go on forever. They have double bunked people in every single cell. They can't get any more than that. They've added many new places in work release for bunks. They can't add any more. They have virtually, truly run out 100% of any space to put any more people. And there is no money to change that. There is no money to upgrade the video system and the audio system and the intercom system and just the security and the safety around the jail for the officers who work there and for the inmates who are inside the jail, because it is up to the county to provide for the safety and the security of those inmates. If an inmate gets sick while at the jail, the county has to cough up the funds to pay for that inmate. Whether we like it or not, it's our tax money when that criminal steps inside that jail. And unfortunately, with the number of meth-involved cases and the number of drug-related problems that are actually coming in with the health deteriorated on these people because of the drugs they've been doing, there is more and more medical cases going on. There are more and more higher-level criminals that are in worse and worse shape, and they're costing more and more money. The county is eating up so much money in the medical costs that the cost, that money that should be going to maintain the jail are almost getting eaten up by what it costs to maintain the health of the people who are doing methamphetamines, the people who are doing these other crimes that they're in jail for. So this money is sorely needed in order to get the jail to a place where it's safer for the officers, where it's appropriately secured, where we'll be able to make sure that the inmates that are there are kept there and not allowed to run free on the streets after they're arrested. So please, when you vote, if you're a registered voter in Whitman County, vote for Proposition 1. It will really help the jail. It will really help the juvenile justice. It will help a lot of situations that need the help. I can't stress that enough. I've actually been in that jail before, not as an inmate. Not as an inmate. I've actually worked there for about 10 years. So I know the system inside and out, and I know that it needs money, and it needs it now. So please help us by voting for Prop 1 in Whitman County. Well, once again, this is Scotty. This is the PES, and we are broadcasting live from the ivory tower of the third floor of the Cub on KZU 90.7 FM. Our studio line is 509-335-2207. The website is www.kzuu.org. And the website for the show is www.thepes.com. And we will end today with the way we started, and as we do every week, with more Reverend Horton Heat.